started attending the church, met my husband that pretty soon after I moved to London. Basically, we'd slept together, and you know, in Paul says in Corinthians, you know, it's better for you to marry than to burn with lust. So we're like, okay, you know, we're gonna get married, do the Christian thing. Got married, and life was brilliant up until a month after we got married, and the police just kicked down our door. They arrested us both.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the publication that sponsors this show, brings it to you each and every week right here on Premier Christian Radio and also on The Profile podcast. And well, have we got a fascinating story to share with you today. I've been speaking to Jendela Benson. Jendela is the author of the critically acclaimed brand new novel, Hope and Glory. But she's been speaking to me about the moment when her life changed dramatically. Recently back from honeymoon, she discovered the police were kicking down her door. She and her husband were arrested on money laundering charges. And I've been speaking to her about how her faith survived that ordeal. Some of the detail of what took place involved her husband going to prison. It involved the love and support of her church family carrying her through an unimaginably difficult time. And as we spoke, I discovered that her story really had quite a profound effect on her own personal views about God, about what living the Christian life is all about, and even what kind of blessings or deliverance should we expect as Christians. I'm grateful to Jendela for opening up and sharing this story with us here at Premier in full for the very first time. I started our conversation, as we often do here on The Profile, by going back to the beginning and asking Jendela what life was like growing up in Birmingham.
Yeah, so I was born in Nigeria, but I moved to the UK with my parents when I was very small, and I grew up in Birmingham where my brother was born. And yeah, it was just the four of us really. Most of my family was either in Nigeria or I had family in London, but in Birmingham it was just kind of like me, my dad, my mom, my brother. It was nice. It was nice, but there were challenges. So I grew up in a kind of like very white working class neighborhood for part of my life, only black girl in my class. I went to a, on the other end of the spectrum, I went to a very like middle class white secondary school, again, the only black girl in my class. So I did have kind of like these troubles around, I guess, identity, like fitting in, like where do I belong? And then, yeah, kind of coming from all different angles. And then there's like this generational thing, like my parents didn't grow up in the UK, they grew up kind of in Nigeria primarily, so there was like that lack of perhaps understanding as to what I was experiencing as kind of like a young kid in Britain. So I definitely felt like I guess all my turmoil was inner, so there wasn't necessarily anything necessarily bad that happened to me like outside. I'll say I had a very like nice childhood, my parents did well. But a lot of the turmoil was kind of inner in terms of who am I? Where do I belong? Like, what is going on? Why do I not feel like just comfortable in my skin, essentially?
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that kind of dual Nigerian-British heritage and how it affected you. Because I think if you're someone who's not had that experience of being the only white or the only black person in a room, it's probably quite hard to understand or identify. Yeah. With. What does that actually feel like? And for you, that sounds like the entirety of your school years. You were having that experience on a daily basis of feeling like the odd one out. Is that the right language?
Yeah, I think it was essentially that, just feeling like the odd one out. So in primary school, all my friends were having like pizza and chips for dinner, and my mum would be making like rice and ground rice and stew and all this Nigerian food. And then there's a kind of like embarrassment, you know, at that age, like you're very young, you just want to be like everyone else. An embarrassment is kind of like I wouldn't say it was shame at that point, because I, as much as I felt odd, I still like really identified as like Nigerian, and I knew that I was, my dad's half Nigerian, half English, so I knew what my heritage was, and I wasn't necessarily ashamed of the heritage, it was just ashamed of not fitting in and kind of like being different. And I think there comes like other things as well. So being like one of the only Black families like in the neighborhood, when stuff happened and the police got involved, because we lived on a road where there was like a police station, like right kind of, it was a long dual carriageway to the police station like halfway up. So when stuff happened, it was like the police would always knock on our door. And in that age, you don't really understand. You're just like, why are they always like knocking on our door? Like they came for my brother like once or twice when he was like really young, like, oh, we've heard that someone's CDs are stolen. And you know, where's your brother? And it's like, my brother was at Mary Hill with my mom shopping. Like, what do you mean? And there's all these kind of like little things that now looking back and you can kind of say, oh, that was like police harassment or that was being profiled. But at the time, it just felt like this big arrow pointing at you, like, you do not belong here. You're the odd one out. You're constantly being singled out. And I think it made me just really want to fit in and just, or at least try and find an identity that I could wear with pride, even if it was kind of like being the odd one out. I remember going to kind of like secondary school and everyone being quite like middle class and from, to my understanding, posh backgrounds. And then I just really leaned into the fact that I wasn't that. So like, I was like, you like using all the slack, like it was quite funny, but just really leaning into the fact, okay, so you're like that, so I'm gonna be all the way this way, like I'm gonna try and own my difference, with like wearing it almost like a costume, I guess. And that kind of carried on for a long, I used to get in a lot of trouble at school, partly I think it was a lot of angst that would just make me act up in school, and that continued until I think I just got to the stage and I was like, I just don't want this any, like, I don't want that aggro. And I've been raised in church, always gone to church from a young age. And we'd started going to this new church and it was like a big youth group. And I remember speaking with like the youth pastors and stuff, just about how unhappy I was at school. And they would like pray for me and they'll pray with me and they'll talk to me about it. And I kind of just decided, you know what? I don't want to be like, I just don't want to feel this way. I don't want to feel constantly like I'm performing. I don't want to feel just so uncomfortable in my own skin. And it was like, I guess it was almost like overnight I feel like I changed. I was the thing, I used to sweat a lot, like that used to be part of my little costume, like just effing and blinding all the time, like trying to be hard or whatever. And I remember overnight I just stopped swearing. Like I was 15 and that was like a big thing to me, like, oh wow, like I just don't swear anymore. And I kind of changed, I guess. And I was like, okay, like I'm not gonna purposely get in trouble, I'm not gonna act up, I'm gonna just, you know, keep my head down, do my GCSEs, all that kind of thing. But funnily enough, after that happened, I actually got suspended like a few weeks later for something that had happened before. So that was a bit like, huh? What? Like, I'm trying to do the right thing and now I'm suspended for something that happened before, which was it was really dumb. I had a little website, I was into like websites, and I'd written like a blog based about how I hated all my teachers, and I'd use their names because I didn't know any better, and the school had found it and I got suspended. So it was like, yeah, it was that was a funny kind of like sequence of events. But after that, yeah, I just went on to college. I left that school, I went to a college where it was way more diverse, I felt a lot more at home, and I really felt like I just flourished. Like, yeah. I was kind of like the Christian girl in college and I was happy, I had lots of friends, like no qualms. And yeah, that was kind of life in Birmingham up until I left.
It sounds like that was quite a profound moment then, in your church and being prayed for. And I suppose a lot of people as teenagers can relate to that sort of struggle of identity and wanting to fit in. But it sounds like from that moment when, was it a youth leader prayed for you, as you say, kind of overnight change. And I know you had a strong, you mentioned Christian upbringing in your family as well. So faith has sort of always been a part of your life?
Yeah, it always has. I remember from a very young age, like going to the Kenneth Copeland like crusades that would happen in Birmingham. I have a very vivid memory of being like 4 or 5 and then doing the altar call and being like, yes, like I want Jesus in my life. And my grandma sadly passed away, but she always used to say, you know, when you were young, you'd be praying in tongues in your sleep and all this kind. Maybe I was just talking in my sleep, who knows? But she was like that was the environment that I grew up around. Like, everyone was very kind of like strong in their faith, and church was like a very big center point for our lives. And I think, especially growing up in these environments where it felt like our family was the odd one out. Like, we went to churches where there were like other Black families or other brown families or just a mix of people, or just like even amongst the white people in church, it wasn't a thing. And I all remember we went to, as a family, we went to go visit this very old white couple who were part of our church, and we went for lunch and we were sitting there and, you know, having a great, like, my parents are talking, and afterwards I remember my dad saying, you know, this wouldn't happen anywhere else but church. Like, there wouldn't be any other environment where this young Black family would go around for lunch with this very like old, like they were probably in their 70s or 80s, and we'd sit down, have lunch, and just be talking and kind of chilling as friends. And I remember my dad very clearly saying that if this wouldn't happen in any other environment, like, that is the thing about Christianity and the gospel. It brings people together that otherwise probably wouldn't even see each other on the street.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming back to your story, you mentioned, I think you moved from Birmingham. You moved down to London next? Just tell me what happened next.
Yeah, so I moved down to London for college or university, and again, it was another big change. I always knew I wanted to move to London, but the actual process of moving was very, I think, hard emotionally, looking back. So yeah, like 16 to 18, I'd found my like niche, and kind of like I was very active in youth at church. I had my college friends. Everything was good. And then I moved to London and I was just really lonely. It was a big kind of change. I am actually an introvert, which kind of surprises some people, but I'm not always very outgoing. And especially then at 18, I was not outgoing at all. I had a lot of kind of just social anxiety about being in all these situations. So I knew a few people in London, but I think that was when I first kind of properly had kind of depression, essentially, like being by myself in London, and back to that not fitting in. So now I'm at art college and I don't fit in there again. I don't have the church community. I don't have that kind of like fallback as I did in Birmingham. So now I'm like just trying to like find myself. And it took a while to, find a church and to kind of find my stride. And but eventually started attending the church, met my husband, actually the person who'd be my husband, like pretty soon after I moved to London. We got into a relationship, and we'd slept together, and you know, in Paul says in Corinthians, you know, it's better for you to marry than to burn with lust. So we're like, okay, you know, we're gonna get married, do the Christian thing, we're not gonna, you know, fornicate or whatever. We got married and life was brilliant up until a month after we got married. I'm laughing, it's not funny at all. A month after we got married and the police just kicked down our door, and it was like the wildest thing. They came, they arrested us both, and it was a real moment, like, again, like I was so baffled, like I had no idea what was going on. But essentially they'd been investigating my husband's business and there was some stuff going on there that they were obviously thought was criminal. So they came, they arrested us, and I was in shock again, knowing nothing about what's kind of like happening, but kind of from my upbringing, my like kind of Pentecostal upbringing, I'm like, this is an attack, like this is, you know, there's going to be a mad testimony that's going to come out of this. Like, my faith was like really kind of like strong and kind of like believing. Long story short, that wasn't the case. We were like, for like almost 2 years, we were on bail, like back and forth from the police station. Every time I'm thinking, no, like, they're going to throw this out. We're going to have this testimony about, oh, you know, they tried to arrest us and God came. And that was like my idea of Christianity. Like, everything's going to work out. We're going to be fine. It's all going to be fine. And it wasn't fine. How long was it? We were up for about 2 years. Then the the thing went to trial, and essentially my husband got convicted for fraud. He got sentenced to 7 years, and I got convicted on money laundering charges because I'd been accepting money from his bank account in the run-up to our wedding and all that kind of thing. And again, it was kind of like going back to the like getting suspended from school situation. It's like, what? Like, God, like, we did all the things that you're meant to do, you know. We were having sex outside of marriage, so we got married. We did all of the things, and this is kind of like the outcome. So that was a massive, massive knock to my faith, I think. I remember the day that the sentencing happened, like, and to add, I was heavily pregnant at that time, so I was very pregnant with our first child. I remember the day the sentence happened, I went back to my grandma's house, I didn't go home. My husband's been taken, so thankfully the judge gave me a suspended sentence, so I didn't have to prison. My husband was sent to prison. I went to my grandma's house, my pastor came to the house, and I remember saying to him, like, I don't get it, like, this Christianity thing it's fake. It must be fake, because I've done all the things. I've ticked all the boxes. I have grown up in church. I've been active. I've served. I got married. I'm doing all the things that we're told that we're meant to do, and this happens. Like, what is going on? And I just remember he didn't have like an answer. He was kind of like, yeah, like I hear you, I hear exactly what you're saying, like, we prayed together. I don't even remember what he said, but we prayed together. My grandma was there as well, and even my grandma was saying to him, you know, pastor, like, explain this to us, like, why did this happen? And he was like, I can't explain that, like, why this happened. And yeah, so that happened, and I kind of just withdrew from everything then. Like, before that, I was a freelance photographer, and I was doing all these projects, and I was out there in the world, like, doing stuff. And then this happened, and I just withdrew from, like, the shame, the paranoia as well. So when everything happened, like, people were sending me screenshots of, like, newspaper articles with, like, our faces and, like, mugshots and all this kind of thing. And it was like, there was just a lot of shame, basically, and I withdrew. And I lost a lot of opportunities as well. Like, I was kind of like writing for places, and I was meant to be like doing things with like certain Christian outlets and whatever else. And when this all happened, it all like went away, which you can say fair enough, right? It all kind of went away. I was meant to be working on a project with like a broadcaster that went away. So I just withdrew, and I think I became quite bitter. Like, very kind of bitter. I will say my church community really stepped up. Like, they were so supportive. They played a big role in why I still kind of consider myself a Christian now, because they were so supportive. They surrounded me, they prayed for us, they were like, whatever you need, we're there. But outside of that, like, the other kind of Christians, and even people who would like come to our wedding and dance and all this kind of thing, was like, there was just a lot of judgment and a lot of like, no one asked any questions. It was like, oh, you need to repent. And I would always say to them, repent of what? Like, tell me what I need to repent from. Oh, well, you know, you've been convicted and da, da, da. And I said, yeah, and I didn't do it. Like, I didn't do it. I didn't know there was anything dodgy happening. Like, even if I did know that there was something dodgy happening, like, would I just be accepting, like, it didn't even make sense. Would I be accepting money into a bank account with my name? Like, if I was trying to, like, launder money, like, surely I wouldn't just be going into the same bank account that I've had since I'm, like, 15. Like, so it just, but people were very much like, this bad thing has happened to you for a reason, and the reason is you've done something wrong. And for, like, a while, I was just, like, apart from like church family and like a few other Christian people in my life, I was just like, I'm done with this whole thing. It's just absolutely fake. Yeah.
It strikes me that sometimes people ask, you know, what's the point in theology? But actually, even in you sharing your story, you think, well, theology really matters, because if we get our theology wrong, it can have some pretty devastating real world consequences, such as if you believe, well, I do my bit, God, and then you promise me an easy life. Like that can that could lead to disappointment, can't it, if we get that wrong?
Age of disappointment, yeah.
And what you say as well about the church community, on the one hand, your local church being great, and on the other hand, I know you said in your TED talk, you're working with a Christian business, and when the court case happened, suddenly they didn't want to know about it and all the work dried up. And it just strikes me that Christians clearly behaved in very, very different ways and probably had very different answers, in quote marks, answers to your situation. It just sounds like you experienced a real breadth of positive and not very positive at all reaction from Christians when you were going through a huge amount, as you say, not just a court case, but being heavily pregnant as well. There's a huge amount to deal with.
Yeah. And it was just so striking. Just like there was one kind of Christian personality who had posted the article of the court case on her Facebook page for people to discuss. And it was like, what on earth? Like, is that what we're doing? Like, is that what we're doing? Like, as Christians, like, she posted it for like people to like weigh in and to discuss the details. And then on the other hand, I had like friends from church who were like praying and constantly kind of like comment, like, is there anything we can do? I didn't need to buy anything for the baby. Like, up until that point, I hadn't really bought anything anyway, because like during the court case, our finances had been restricted and all that kind of stuff. But they gave me clothes, gave me pants, like everything. I didn't need to buy anything. They like proper just held me. So you had this like mad spectrum of like responses from people who were calling themselves Christian. And I honestly say that the way that my local church reacted, I think, is the grace of God, because if it wasn't for them, I don't know if I would still like be in the church. That is the honest truth.
Yeah. And presumably around this time, you must be having some very upfront conversations with your husband, because as you tell the story, you're about to get married. You know, I can remember from when I got married, you know, transferring money between bank accounts, very normal thing to do, paying for wedding expenses, getting the honeymoon sorted. So as far as you were concerned, this was just normal money being exchanged. Yeah. And then next thing you know, when the police get involved and there's talk of money laundering and fraud, presumably you go back to your husband and saying, hey, what's going on here? What were those conversations like?
So I literally was like, what is happening? And he told me, you know, like, no, it's a mistake, it's a misunderstanding, da, 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 da. So I just went with it. I was like, okay, fine. Again, I'm waiting for that mad testimony, like my equivalent of like God sending fire down from heaven to like burn. I'm waiting for that kind of like story. And and obviously everything happened, and I guess, to be honest, we didn't speak about it for a while, because it was kind of like trying to work out, what do we do now? But then over the years, like as time has gone on and we've kind of spoken, and he's admitted that, like I was doing some dodgy stuff and you shouldn't have been involved. Like, I shouldn't have got you involved in that kind of thing. And that's been like a journey for us. And it's a journey for him, because I'll even say that now, like, he no longer identifies as a Christian. Like, he's kind of left the faith in that respect. And I think that's from his experiences. Like, he's gone through his own, like, I can't even imagine what prison's like. He's gone through his own thing with prison. He was there for 4 years, and he came out of that like, you know what, I'm kind of like done Christianity, like I don't like believe it anymore. So we've kind of been on this journey as a married couple, where we both started in this very like similar place. This crazy thing happened that split us apart physically, but we were very much kind of like there emotionally. But then as time has gone on, obviously just challenges, like different viewpoints, and it's another learning curve for me, I would say, because again, you believe I did the right thing, I got married when I was meant to get married, I did all these things. And one thing I will say is, I never thought I really had like that kind of like quote unquote prosperity mindset. Like, I always kind of thought, yeah, like, I don't believe, you know, sow £5 and you'll get £20 back. But now realizing that I did have that mindset, just not with money, but with like my work. So I thought, because I did all these things, God owed me based on my faithfulness. But So that's like a side point. But yeah, like the conversations have been quite hard over the years. We've been through marriage counselling like twice. We're still working through that as a couple, because prison just is like an even when the person leaves prison, like it's an ongoing trauma that like you're kind of like dealing with. We've got two kind of sons together, and my husband has a daughter who's older as well. So there's three children all, and that's like another dynamic. Like when he went to prison, there was his daughter, but she didn't live with us, so we didn't have any children under our house. And then now he's back and there's two children and all this kind of stuff. So it's been a journey, I think, and another kind of like journey of faith, in the sense of trying to make sense of, okay, like what do I think marriage means? Like when it isn't the fairy tale wedding, and you know, everyone in the church clapping for you because you did the right thing, then all the Instagram love because your couple goals, like what does kind of that look like? And it's I can't give you an answer because it's an ongoing, like we're still in it. It's an ongoing thing.
Holier than thou.
Radical.
Delusional.
Ignorant.
Perfect. It's time to challenge stereotypes about Christians, and Premier Christianity is leading the way.
Transform your perceptions, broaden your horizons, open your mind to wide-ranging views.
Read interviews with politicians, theologians, and TV presenters.
Discover the breadth of the Christian spectrum.
Be provoked, react, inspired, and informed. Get the print magazine and full online access for just £4.95 a month. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
The bigger picture.
I often get to talk to people who've been through some really, really challenging life circumstances. And of course, most of the time, by nature of what I do, they're still identifying as a Christian. Their faith may look very different, but you do just think, wow, it's a work of God in people's lives, as you say, because it's like you say, it could so easily have gone in a different direction. And in a sense, no one would blame you. You know, you think to go through all that upheaval, you know, no one would blame you. You think, well, you know, she's been through a lot and she's working things out. But as you say, you are still a Christian. You still have faith. Your faith might look different or might have changed. Yeah. But I mean, you've already spoken about how the church community was vital in that, in supporting you when your husband was in prison, you're raising kids alone and rallying around you practically. Have there been other things on the journey in recent years that you think that's really kept me going? That's kept my faith alive.
Yeah. So after kind of everything happened, and I remember I was still going to church because that was where my community was, but I wasn't, there was like just a coldness, I think, to everything. I'm going to church because of the people and because I feel the love, support, but there was a coldness towards God, because I was very much like, why did this happen? And I don't even know what you would call that. I guess kind of like almost like a not practicing Christian, because I wasn't like doing all the things. I was in church in body, but I wasn't like there in like mind or spirit really. And I actually remember it was when Stormzy's album came out called Gang Signs and Prayer, and there's that song on it, Blinded by Your Grace. And I remember listening to the album through and getting to that song and just breaking down into like floods of like, yeah, even just thinking about it, it makes me like, well, look, I was like, Lord, I've been broken because I'm not worthy, like you fix. I was just crying in my bedroom. And I think that was the moment when I was, I don't know, something kind of like clicked, in a sense of where you can say, why you, but almost why not you? Like, what about you makes you so special that you don't need to go through certain trials? And yes, your trials look different to everyone else's and your story is not the same as anyone else, but it's like we're all going through something, so why do you deserve to have the easy life in that sense? And that was a big turning point for me, because I think now emotionally I was getting back to God, and I was kind of like, I'd been through that like anger and that kind of just hardness of heart, and now I was kind of like, okay, like I don't know. I still don't know, have that answer to why, but it's, again, it's like you can't even really describe it. We were actually at a friend's house over the weekend, and because my husband's not a Christian and we were all Christian, so as this happens, you get into like these political, religious kind of like debates, and we were talking about miracles and like the nature of miracles, and like, you know, has anyone seen like a miracle happen like in the Bible, like where a dead man walks, whatever. And I was just thinking, like, the fact that I am here is a miracle. Like, the fact that I'm here is actually a miracle. Like I've struggled with depression. When I was younger, I struggled with like suicidal ideation. I've been through all these things, and the fact that I'm here is a miracle. And if you can, and if someone's to say, why are you here, it's like, I can't explain it. Like, and it, like, going back to that moment, like listening to Blinded by Your Grace, I can't explain what happened, but something just broke open, and I was like, wow. I guess it was almost like seeing, yes, this happened, but seeing all the ways that God was present, kind of like walking. So whether it was through the church, or even going back to kind of like being in the courtroom, and the fact that the police wanted the judge to give my husband 10 years and the judge gave him kind of like the least that he could possibly give, which was 7 years. And the judge, I remember the judge saying to me, you know, like, kind of essentially saying, like, you're going to have your baby, you're not going to have your baby in prison, you're going to go home. And I believe that this is just essentially a mistake that you're going to move past. And looking back on that now and see, like, I see that as the grace of God, because someone else could have said, no, that's it, you've messed up. Like, I don't want to hear excuses. I just see you, convicted criminal, go to jail, kind of thing. So, like, looking back in my life and seeing these moments where it was like, I think that was God.
Hey, this is Sam. Really hope you're enjoying this conversation right here on the Profile podcast today. Could you do me a favor right now? It'll take you just 2 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. Just a couple of seconds to give us a rating is so, so helpful. It helps other people to discover the show as well. So if you could do that, we would so appreciate it.
I was introduced to a woman who basically was experiencing the exact same thing. And she was essentially 2 years ahead of me in the process. So her husband had been sentenced 2 years before. She had like young children, and a friend introduced us, and we just started speaking. Like, I remember the first conversation, I think we were on the phone for like 2 hours, like a woman that I've never met before in my life. And we were kind of just like talking and talking, and that was looking, and then I can look back now and say, oh, that was the grace of God in that situation. Like, that was God looking out for me when I wasn't even thinking anything about him. Like, I was still angry. I was still like, why did you do this? Why did you allow this to happen? What? Why? Is all of my faith for nothing, essentially? But he was, God was there looking out for me, and
I'm really grateful to you for opening up about all of this that's happened in your life. How does it affect you now in terms of, you know, is it a subject you want to talk about? Is it a subject you kind of want to just forget about? Does it come up in day-to-day life, both personally and professionally, and kind of how have you dealt with that?
So it kind of hasn't, it's not something that comes up day-to-day, like kind of like professionally. And I guess I have kind of spoken about it. I did the TED talk. I've like written about like kind of certain aspects, but I think this is the first time that I'm actually telling the whole kind of like story. And I guess it's something that I've not wanted to talk about before, because I just, it just felt too painful. I still guess felt maybe a certain weight of shame about it, and just like not having maybe a space to kind of say everything. It's like, I just don't want to talk about it all. And then also part of it was like, it's not 100% my story. Like, it's very much my husband's story as well. And I don't necessarily want to talk about that. And then there's also just the practicalities. Like, I've served my time. Like, I don't need to declare, I don't need to speak about it. I don't need to declare it. Like, what's, there's that, there's that law that, you know, I can't remember, when your conviction's spent, like, you don't need to declare it for certain crimes. So that I don't need to talk about. And for a long time, I was like, yeah, that's in the past. Like, I don't want to bring it up. But I think more so now, more recently, like, that is my story. That is why that has led me to where I am now. I don't think I would be doing the work that I do with Black Ballad, or I would have written even a novel, without that point in my life where I just stopped, withdrew, and kind of was a hermit for however long, like a year, 18 months. Because again, even in those kind of like dark moments, like looking back, I can see how God was kind of like shaping paths and opportunities that have led to now. So I think now I'm kind of in the respect that it's my story. Yeah. So I can't deny it. And if it helps someone else, just to know that, you know, you can go through some absolute madness and God can still use you. God can still use it, the madness. That doesn't have to be the thing that defines you. And for a long time, I felt like if I talk about it, it's going to be the thing that defines me. Everyone's going to think about me as the person that went through this, or the person whose husband's in prison, or whatever, whatever. And now I guess I'm just at a space where I'm like, my life, by the grace of God, is so full with so many other things. This can't define me. I can't allow imagined shame to hold me back, because, you know, Romans says there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ. Like, do I believe in Christ Jesus? Do I believe that, or do I not believe that? It just comes down to that.
Yeah, that's great. So help us join the dots then between some of your story and the novel. The novel, as I said, Hope and Glory, even before it came out, there was a lot of people talking about this book. I remember, as I often do, flicking through the Sunday Times Star magazine, and there you were, 10 faces to know in 2022. So even before the book came out, it was attracting attention, which you must have been delighted with. But just help us understand how the novel kind of relates to some of what we've already spoken about.
Yeah, so I think so the novel actually came about because an editor approached me and was like, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I was like, yeah, like, don't we all imagine like writing a book? So I started working on this story, and I think when I started working on the story, I was in a place of still, I don't know what's going on with life. I don't really have a career. I just have this feeling of, I guess, shame that my parents have sacrificed so much, and look at where my life is, you know. For all intents and purposes, I'm a single mom whose partner's in prison, who's not really doing anything of note. So I started writing this story about Glory, who is in that position, in a sense where she has left the UK to like go and make her name in LA, and it's not going the way that she wants. Like, she's kind of feeling like, what is happening? And then a massive tragedy happens. Her dad dies, and she comes back to London, and she finds her family in disarray. Her brother is in prison, which obviously was inspired by my experience of having a husband in prison. Her sister is like kind of perfect on the outside, but Glory has her suspicions about her marriage, and her mom's on the verge of kind of like a mental health breakdown, which I guess was almost like my projections of fear and shame and all these kind of things, I think, was kind of living in this family who all these tragedies have happened to them, and they're in this very close-knit community. And again, everyone's kind of looking at them like, why you? Like, why are you the ones that have tragedy after tragedy after tragedy? Like, what is happening? So that was the starting point. And I think I wrote it over the course of 3 years, because, you know, children, it's a lot. But as I was writing, I think I went on this journey of just unpacking, I think, a lot of shame, and unpacking kind of like family and what that means, and what almost like redemption. I think it's also a story about redemption as well, but redemption that people can have for each other, like people who have wronged each other, particularly family members, or people who are fractured because of various things. So there's like a big family secret in the novel, which is kind of a point of contention between Glory and everyone else. Almost like you as a family can go through all these things and you can still find redemption. Not perfect, like all of a sudden your brother isn't out of prison and back home and, you know, yay, and dad's back. And it's not that, but there is a way to work through these hard experiences. And I think that that came a lot from me and what I was going through, and kind of channeling that hope and also the love that I have found being surrounded with by church, by family, by the friends who kind of like stuck by, kind of channeling it all into that novel.
I understand that, that writing actually is, has been a huge sort of interest of yours from a very, very early age, actually. Was it 7 years old you were sort of starting to write a novel?
I tried. I tried desperately to write a novel. So I've been a big reader from a very young age. And of course, like, my favourite book as a child was The Secret Garden. Like, I absolutely loved that book. But it wasn't about a little girl like me. So I wanted to write a story about a little girl like me. So I called it The African Princess, and I tried. And I think maybe I got a couple chapters in and I was like, oh, this is too hard. So I kind of shelved it. And it sounds ridiculous, but I literally had it in my mind, well, writing books just isn't for me. Like, at this very young age, I can't do it. Like, I'll write poems or like short stories or whatever instead. So, yeah, writing has always been, I've kept a journal since I was about 13, which I found the other day when my dad was like clearing out the house and brought me this massive box full of journals. And I was reading back and I was like, oh my gosh, all the angst and the, oh, it's heartwarming, but it's a bit cringe as well. But yeah, so writing has always been the way that I process things. And yeah.
But it's something you're obviously very good at. I mean, even just reading your work online and some of your blog posts, which, you know, are just, you know, superbly well written.
Thank you.
Do you know that you're onto a winner while you're writing it? Do you feel like I'm in the flow now, whether it's a blog or your Black Ballad or the book? Is there a moment where you're like, yeah, I'm on it?
I think there is, but I will say that the first draft always feels like the worst thing that I have ever written in my life. No matter what it is, the first draft of anything, even if it's like a short blog post, I'm always like, what? I'm, like, this is absolutely terrible. Can I even do this anymore? And then you leave it, you come back to it and you're editing it and you can kind of see, oh, okay. Like, I feel like I know when I'm onto something, when I feel like if I could just speak, and it would sound like this, I would be happy. So if I feel like it's like me talking just better, then I'm like, okay, yeah, this works. But you have to go through the, what on earth is this rubbish?
It's so true. But you have to go back and edit yourself. I mean, I do this, and I say this all the time, that every writer needs a good editor, and including editors. So I'm an editor, but I need an editor. You know, everything I write goes through other people, and there's something about that first draft. I can relate to that sometimes. I'm not feeling it's very good, but once you go back, I often think with writing it's just a question of how much time you have. If you had all the time in the world, you could carry on going back, make it better and better and better. In journalism, we don't have that, as you know, we don't have that much time. Is there a bit more time in the book writing process though, to kind of really shape things?
There definitely is more time. But at some point, you just need to be like, this is it.
Yeah.
I did an event and someone asked like me about Hope and Glory and like, oh, is there anything that I would change? And I was like, I can think of a million things that would have made the book even better. But I know that when I finished that book, that was the best that I gave at that point. And I just have to make peace with that, because otherwise you'll never get anything done or put anything out there, because you're constantly like, just trying to be, and nothing's perfect, like perfection doesn't exist, so all you can do is just do your best, and if you can stand by it, that, like, my measurement is, can I stand by this and say I did the absolute best that I could? Yes, I can see where it could have been done better, but that was the best that I had at the time, then we go with that.
And presumably this is only the first of many.
I'm working through this, I'm editing the second book that I've written, and I've got a bunch of book ideas in me, so I'm hoping to continue writing for a long time.
You've spoken a lot about your Christian upbringing, how your faith has changed over time, but obviously, you know, you're working with the book and I guess with Black Ballad as well, you're working in kind of mainstream, sometimes non-Christian environments, but you're someone who's very upfront and open about who you are as a Christian. How has that been? Has that been straightforward to live as a Christian in a mainstream world, or has that brought challenges?
Honestly, I would say it's been quite straightforward. The challenges that have come have been from other Christians who maybe think that I shouldn't be doing this, or I shouldn't be doing it like that, or you working in this capacity is compromising your faith. That has been the biggest challenge. But other than that, like most, like, yeah, other people are very much like, thankfully I work in a realm where faith isn't a taboo. I work mainly with Black women around Black women. So even if it's not a Black woman of faith, whether that's a Muslim or a Christian or some other kind of religion, there's still that kind of background of, we know, like we've grown up around it, we know the kind of score. So I've never felt a way about my faith in that kind of aspect. I feel like it's just been space for a lot of great conversations, like meeting different people from different backgrounds and different kind of like perceptions, and just being open to those like potentially challenging conversations. And kind of, I've enjoyed that, and I think people are very gracious, and my experience is that people have been very gracious and kind of very much kind of accepting of who I am, as and I'm accepting of who they are as well. And I've learned a lot of grace myself, just being in these like quote-unquote non-Christian environments and being around people with different beliefs, and I think I'm better for it. But yeah, I know that there's been conversations I've had with other Christians who are kind of like, well, you know, shouldn't you always be writing about God, or shouldn't you only be writing, oh, is Hope and Glory a Christian novel? And it's like, first of all, what does that mean, a Christian novel? And second of all, it probably isn't whatever you think it's going to be. I'll just, like, let's get everyone's expectations in line. There's not an altar call at the back of the book, no. And even to a certain degree, some might say that the depiction of Christianity in Hope and Glory, some people might not necessarily like it, because it's Glory's mother as she's kind of like struggling through her issues. Like, she turns to faith in a way that I think a lot of us have seen, especially in like older kind of African generations, where it is that very like quid pro quo, like, you pay a holy person £200 and they will bless you and give you that fire. So some people might even take like umbrage with that, but that is that's the story that I felt like I had to tell.
And it's based in reality, isn't it? That's the thing. It may be a novel, but it's based on the reality that there are Christians out there, or there are churches out there that do things in that way. And all you're doing is you're fairly inaccurately representing something that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd hope so.
I wonder if there's I can relate to this. I wonder if there's a category error sometimes, isn't there, with Christians? We have this as a magazine where it's basically, but why aren't you preaching the area of theology and doctrine I personally agree with? I think, well, because a Christian magazine doesn't exist just to feed back to you all of what you already believe. It exists to broaden your horizons. And in the same way, why isn't there an altar call at the back of a novel? Well, because a novel isn't supposed to do that. That's not what a novel does. So I can relate to that. I think there's a bit of an education needs to happen sometimes in the church, in terms of when people are called to particular careers or areas of work, that, yeah, you're called to be a Christian in that world, but you're not necessarily called to be a street preacher evangelist in the way that some people think you are.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not anyone's pastor or preacher or teacher. Like, that is not where, like, if you want that, there are very clear avenues to go to, you know, get your theological educate. Like, I'm a big fan of theology. I listen to kind of like a lot of theological podcasts. I find that all fascinating, but that is not my calling. I'm not an apologist. I'm not a theologian. I'm just a Christian who, I've been blessed with this talent, and this is how I feel led to use it. And ultimately, I can only do that prayerfully and faithfully.
Well, I don't know if you intended it as a sales pitch or not, but it worked for me when you said that whatever you think the novel is, it isn't. I think that's a fantastic sales pitch. So if you want to check it out, it's called Hope and Glory by Jandela Benson, and it's out now wherever books are sold. Jandela, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me right here on The Profile on Premier Christian Radio. It's been wonderful to have your company with us this afternoon. I hope that story from Jandela has provoked some thought in you, maybe even inspired you. As Jandela said in the interview, she's sharing this story because she hopes it speaks to someone about God's goodness and God's presence, even in the darkest of moments. Her debut novel, Hope and Glory, is out now and available wherever books are sold. And you can also read that conversation in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine. The July issue is out right now. Our cover story is about how to find peace in the age of anxiety. We're also looking at the important topic of how to raise the next generation. We've got a fantastic article from Loretta Andrews on raising anti-racist kids. And R.T. Kendall has been sharing with us in his article, The Road Less Travelled, How to Live for the Approval of God Alone and Not Worry What People Think of You. So there's lots of fantastic, positive and encouraging content in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine. And we've got a really special summer offer running for a limited period of time while the weather is so glorious. Why not check it out now? 3 print issues of the UK's leading Christian magazine, full access to our website, and the digital edition as well, all for just £5 for not one, not two, but 3 issues of the magazine. That's right, you can get 3 print issues of the magazine delivered to your door for just £5. The full details are available right now at premierchristianity.com/subscribe. I do hope you have a wonderful rest of your weekend. We'll be back same time, same place next week with another fantastic story for you. See you then.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.
Saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection. Choose from 26 stylish colors and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save money.